From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In just 3 weeks, ISIS has apparently carried out 3 international terror attacks: a Russian plane over Egypt, death in Beirut, and last Friday's horror in Paris. Almost 400 dead in total. That suggests a fair amount of coordination and communication. Intelligence services are looking at the encrypted, hard-to-snoop-on dark web as one culprit, an ISIS advantage. CIA Director John Brennan suggests Paris should be a wake-up call on the cyber fight against ISIS, that more needs to be done to track and spy. This is a long debate now since 9/11, and it's back on. This hour On Point, ISIS Online and the Cyber Challenge. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What would you sign off on now when it comes to surveillance and spying? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're going to dive into this from a lot of angles today. Joining me first in the studio, and it's great to have her, Shira Frankel, cybersecurity reporter for BuzzFeed. She's been looking at all the issues here. Shira, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So can we just talk first about the security threat in the United States? ISIS came out with this video. Washington was named as a potential target. There is a pattern. When they name, they hit. We've heard all kinds of stuff from people in Washington lately. What are you hearing about the perceived security threat right now?
Well, I mean, you can't accuse ISIS of hiding its intentions. Until now, whenever it's said that it's going after a target, it has tried with every manner and means at its disposal to go after that target. They came out with a video specifically saying that they were going to come after Washington, D.C. And what's interesting is that those videos, that video in specific, and the videos that have come afterwards, they've been translated into English. They're using French. They're using Russian. They're clearly in a new stage where they're trying to come after European countries, American countries. They're speaking our language, and they're telling us we're coming for you. And we've heard senators, we've heard congressmen coming out of classified intelligence briefings saying there is specific intelligence, that they're planning operations here in the United States.
Here was just one example of that on Monday. This was Senator Dianne Feinstein, California, ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Intelligence Committee, saying she's very concerned.
I don't want to make everybody nervous, but I feel the same way I felt before 9/11, that something very well could happen here.
Doesn't want to make everybody nervous, but that's pretty nervous-making, as they say right there. Is there concrete evidence, or is this just ISIS threatening, and so they threaten and people pay attention?
Well, you know, it's funny. I just came back from Washington, D.C., and I actually met with a senator who's on an intelligence committee where he gets a lot of those classified briefings. He used the word chatter a lot, which is something I think we hear people in the intelligence community saying. We've heard chatter about strikes here in Washington. We've heard chatter about strikes in New York. And when you try to sort of ask them the specificity, you know, what is chatter? They go, well, you know, mentions that we would deduce from that. So I don't think that at the moment there's like, you know, a date or a time that they think. That's not how ISIS work. Mm-hmm. ISIS, we know it to send operatives into the field, and they seek crimes of opportunity. So when they can launch attacks, they do. And that's in some ways the most frightening for intelligence officials, because it's very hard to pinpoint an operative who's in a city loose with a gun.
Now, we did see top intelligence officials move in right away after the weekend and everybody absorbing what happened there to say, we need more surveillance range and scope here. This was Monday. John Brennan, director of the CIA, talked to the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, talking about the ability of the CIA to get information on terrorist threats. Here he is.
I do think this is a time for particularly Europe, as well as here in the United States, for us to take a look and see whether or not there have been some inadvertent or intentional gaps that have been created in the ability of intelligence and security services to protect the people that they are asked to serve.
John Brennan, head of the CIA. And then this, Shira, I'm sure you heard this. Everybody paid it. This is what really got everybody's attention. He seemed to take a big swipe at all the pushback, pro-privacy, pro-civil liberties pushback. That's been a very deep and important debate since 9/11. He called it hand-wringing and said, well, we need a wake-up call here, critical of what Edward Snowden had leaked and more. Here's the CIA director again.
In the past several years, because of a number of unauthorized disclosures and a lot of hand-wringing over the government's role in the effort to try to uncover these terrorists, there have been some policy and legal and other actions that are taken that make our ability collectively, internationally, to find these terrorists much more challenging. And I do hope that this is going to be a wake-up call.
Shira Frenkel is with me in the studio, covers all this for BuzzFeed. Shira, we thought it was just 5 minutes ago that we got this settled, that we had pushed back some of this NSA and CIA surveillance, or at least established more clear oversight of it. And already, right on the heels of Paris, he's saying, we need more freedom. What's he want and why, and how's Congress responding?
Look, I think in the wake of any kind of attack that we can't understand, which was, I mean, you can color this any way you want. There was an intelligence failing here. A group of attackers with advanced weapons managed to hit one of Europe's largest cities. That's an intelligence failing.
And not just in one spot, but all over.
Exactly. This was a well-planned, coordinated attack that intelligence officials completely missed. And we've heard in the wake of it that Turkey and Jordan and Israel and other places—
said heads up.
Right. They said, hey, something's coming your way. Mm-hmm. But Obama was very clear in his speech that there was not a specific intelligence mm-hmm. warning, and that France gets warnings every single day that something might be up. So it's great to say, hey, France, we told you that ISIS wanted to hit you, but if they're hearing that every single day, they had no way to prepare for this specific attack. So you're sitting here and you're the head of the CIA and you're being called on to give answers. Why mm-hmm. did you guys fail? And I think that encryption, this idea that there's a deep, dark web, is a very easy thing to go to because people are afraid of it. They don't understand it. And it's an incredibly complex issue that, unfortunately, when it just gets made into headlines and into, like, easy to grab to quotes, it gets reduced down to something very simple.
You think it's a dodge that CIA is hiding behind the dark web? No, I mean, they're saying, look at all this encryption. So many PlayStations are out there. We can't track all this Tor and Telegram and WhatsApp and Kik and Kick.
I'll be honest. I've been a journalist for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And when I get the same answer over and over again from intelligence officers saying, oh, yeah, encryption's to blame. And then all you do is ask a follow-up question, which is how? How is encryption? If you could right now have the keys to every single encrypted email, could you have stopped that attack? And then they hem and they haw and they say, well, you know, maybe these. But you ask them, what kind of intelligence are you getting from these encrypted emails? And it's things like, oh, well, they write things like the weather will be good tomorrow. Or, hey, are you going to the weather? So
even if you saw it, you might not know what it meant if it's code.
Exactly.
But the push is strong here. We hear, again, Dianne Feinstein talking about this out of the Senate Foreign Intelligence Committee, saying the use of encryption makes detecting terrorists that much harder.
A lot of the communication between these networks is encrypted. Even simple commercial products that you can buy encrypt the conversation. And some of them encrypted in a way that even with a court order, you can't break into it.
And, of course, Washington has asked Silicon Valley for backdoors. Silicon Valley has said no so far. We'll talk about that. Backdoor, and sometimes it's front door. Sony PlayStation has come up in the midst of all this. It was last week before the attacks. Belgium's interior minister, Deputy Prime Minister Jan Jambon, spoke with Politico's Matthew Kaminsk about the difficulties with ISIS. He said using maybe Sony PlayStation, the video game console, to communicate.
I heard that the most difficult communication between these terrorists is the PlayStation 4. Very, very difficult for our services, not only ours, Belgian services, but all the international services to decrypt the communication that's done via PlayStation 4.
All right, PlayStation 4 out there as well. I mean, we're reading about, Shira, that potentially you can send a message by within the game using your machine gun to spray writing bullet pox on a wall in a game. Hard to get into. Shira Frenkel with BuzzFeed. Stand by. Aaron Brantley joins us right now from West Point, New York, professor of international relations at West Point, research fellow at the U.S. Army Cyber Institute and at the Army-affiliated Combating Terrorism Center. Author of the forthcoming The Decision to Attack, Military and Intelligence Cyber Decision Making. Aaron Brantley, thank you very much for being with us from West Point today.
Hi, Tom.
How important do you now see the cyber front with ISIS? I mean, after all, in the end, these were attacks in a theater, around a stadium, at cafes, on the street. Is this a cyber contest or an old-fashioned stop the terrorists challenge?
Well, I think that it's kind of evolved into both. So they've kind of moved their effort to organizing within cyberspace. We see a lot of communications in cyberspace where they're discussing how to plan and organize, how to maintain operational security to avoid intelligence agencies, and a whole host of other functions. And so whereas before, you know, they kind of used the sneaker net to kind of plan and develop operations, now they're using the internet. And they're doing a quite good job of it. They're planning a lot of operations using highly encrypted off-the-shelf technologies. They're teaching one another, and they're really developing in a solid learning environment. And that poses a lot of challenges to U.S. intelligence agencies, global intelligence agencies, and law enforcement agencies.
It's been a long time since anybody in that world just used open email. I mean, Osama bin Laden years ago, they found letters when he was killed, you know, older letters saying don't use plain email. I mean, people have known that for a long time. Is it obvious? Is it actually known that ISIS has embraced all this encryption stuff? Is that known and knowable, Aaron?
Yes, it is known. It's knowable. We released a report at the Combating Terrorism Center earlier this year in May detailing a lot of the various tools and technologies that they're using. We also detailed how they're developing training platforms. We've collected more than 300 documents of training manuals teaching one another through the dark web and other resources how to evade intelligence and law enforcement agencies. So it's clearly known. They're clearly evolving. The use of encryption is a persistent and reoccurring thing within this community.
Sure. You've even reported in others they've got a jihadi help desk out there for people who need backup. Forgive me if it wasn't your reporting, but I've just read it, where you can sort of call, I don't know, 800 right. ISIS, and how do I use this encryption?
We've actually not reported that because we
Forgive
don't
me.
Think – it's okay. We don't think there's a lot of legitimacy.
Ah.
I think that if
you – Urban myth.
Well,
exploding.
I mean,
okay.
I don't imagine that the jihadis want to create a 1-800 number for the CIA to dial up. And I think if you're having problems figuring out Tor or PGP – they have helplines that you can call. I don't really imagine that many of these guys are going to want to ring into Raqqa. Mm-hmm. I think that to the other points about encryption, once again, I think that a lot of intelligence agencies have said this has been around a long time for a variety of jihadi groups, not just ISIS.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the push post-Paris for more, not less, electronic surveillance. The head of the CIA doesn't want to be constrained, wants more access. And the tension over rights and privacy is back. Aaron Brantley is with us. He's a research fellow at the U.S. Army Cyber Institute, joins us from West Point today. Shira Frankel's here from BuzzFeed, cybersecurity reporter there. We'll hear from Jamil Jaffer in a moment at the ACLU and Dakota Wood at the Heritage Foundation, the debate over whether or not the reins need to be loosened again on American intelligence. You can join us this hour. What do you think? With no proof so far that this was key to Paris, why the push now? Is it obvious? Without Snowden, ISIS might know less about how U.S. spying works, but so would we. Are we better off knowing? And should we change the rules again after Paris? Here was Republican Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, talking yesterday about the use of encryption by ISIS.
It's a wake-up call for America and for our global partners that globally we need to begin the debate on what we do on encrypted networks, because it makes us blind to the communications and to the actions of potential adversaries.
And, of course, there was this week that ISIS threat, formal, official, or whatever you call it or not clear, but a video threatening the United States and Washington in particular, interpreted by CNN.
We say to the countries that participate in the Crusader campaign, I swear to God, a similar day that France went through, you will go through. I swear to God, as we struck France in its stronghold, Paris, we will strike America in its stronghold, Washington, with God's will.
Lots of folks mustering here. Even the online hacker group Anonymous released an online video after the Paris attacks where Anonymous declares war on ISIS. Here it is.
Any organizations and enterprises linked to those terrorist attacks should expect a massive reaction from Anonymous. We are tracking you down. We will find you and not leave you any rest.
Anonymous speaks there. Aaron Brantley and Shira Frankel with us. Michael's calling from Boston. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to, every time Joe Brennan opens his freaking mouth, he annoys me a little bit more.
The CIA director. The idea, why?
Yes. The idea that she can fight what is basically a mathematical impossibility of putting encryption, really hard encryption, really, really difficult encryption, back in the box just by putting a backdoor on the commercially available services is ridiculous. All that's doing is making it harder for, say, political dissidents in China, in Vietnam, and other parts of the world that want to speak without fear of their government finding them more vulnerable. these encryption services do not go back into the technological box by putting backdoors into what the average person can get their hands on.
So dissidents that you might support, we might support, use this to get, to evade authoritarian governments. ISIS also uses it. How do we weigh those two things? Michael, let us hold that thought. I want to take it to my guest. One more call first. Joe in Lincoln, Nebraska. Joe, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just want to point out that if we put a backdoor into our cellular system for the NSA, Russia and China and criminal enterprises all over the world will eventually gain access to that backdoor. It's not a question of if, it's only a question of when.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure you're right. Joe, I appreciate your call. Aaron Brantley, you being from West Point working affiliated with the U.S. Army there, I didn't know where you would come down on this, but as I understand it, you share some of these same concerns, that if you do install a backdoor, you make lots of people vulnerable to snooping, including those whose causes we might well support.
Yeah, absolutely. So I cut my technological teeth working with human rights and democracy activists around the world. And so putting backdoors into cryptographic programs is a recipe for that serves no one. It benefits no one. The simple fact is that, you know, this is not a large-scale data analytics problem. It's a cooperation, sharing, targeted information problem. And I think that even though we see terrorist organizations using multiple platforms to communicate and to answer questions on how to become more secure using cryptographic programs, the central focus should be not on the fact that they're using cryptographic programs, but how do we get inside of their innovation cycle? How do we disrupt where they're trying to go so that we catch them before they get into the cycle, or that we try and prevent their attacks using targeted measures rather than trying to compromise cryptographic programs writ large?
What do you mean by getting inside their innovation cycle?
So obviously you don't just sign up for jihad. You participate in a process, an evolution of getting involved in this. You start by, you know, looking on social media. You start evolving into this process over time. And so we can start stopping people before they go into the process, or we can catch them as they're entering the process. In fact, what we've seen over and over again is that in the forums, in the chat rooms, in the interpersonal communications in these various encrypted platforms, they explicitly say, don't assume that this is a trust-based relationship. Assume that we're not in a trust-based relationship. So if somebody asks you to come and meet them for a coffee or something like that, they're probably not asking you from ISIS. They're probably asking you from a law enforcement agency or an intelligence community agency. And so what we need to do is we need to figure out how they're getting these people from the point of being interested to getting on the ground in Syria and Iraq or North Africa, and then what they do when they come back. And so that's where we intercept at multiple points along the way. So we track them as they leave the country to go to these fights. We track them as they come back. But most importantly, we prevent them from even wanting to go into the fight in the first place.
We'll look at that piece. Shara Frankel's written about that. But what about the whole idea of amping up mass surveillance? Is it practical? Is it helpful? Is it essential?
So from a cryptographic standpoint, it's a recipe for disaster. I think it's the second caller indicated.
Why?
First of all, cryptographic programs protect almost all commerce. They protect a lot of different aspects of global security. And when you build you write a mathematical problem, right? So somebody wants to solve it. And so this is kind of a cat and mouse game. So if we put a backdoor in, somebody else is going to find the backdoor. And so we need to really be conscious of what we're trying to do here. And we have an intelligence community that is trying to solve a lot of really good problems. They're trying to pull all the resources in, and it's part of our responsibility as citizens in a civil society to debate the merits of how far we want them to go. I recently had lunch with General Hayden, and he said, look, we'll go as far as the American people want us to go, and we will go no further. And so, you know, while the various jihadist organizations that we've found in communications have obviously cited Edward Snowden's various comments on various cryptographical programs, then that's okay, because we're in a civil society where we can express our values and we can combat terrorism through other means, and a whole lot of other means that are much more successful than breaking down the foundations of commerce, security, and privacy.
Well, thanks to you guys. We're having that citizen debate right here. Tom in Fitchburg, Wisconsin. Tom, you're on. What do you think?
Well, I think when you look at projects like the Able Danger project, you can see that we were actually surveilling on the hijackers of 9/11 far before 9/11 happened. So I don't know what good it really does to surveillance on all the American public when a lot of times, you know, you got the government allows these sort of terrorist attacks to happen in order for them to achieve their own political agenda. And then, you know, on top of it, sometimes you can see that they create the boogeymen. They're funding these terrorists, be it ISIS, ISIL, Al-Qaeda, the way that we funded Osama bin Laden as the name Tim Osman.
I mean, a lot of inadvertency there. I don't know if I'm with you when you get into the government saying, hey, let's go ahead and have the attacks. France doesn't seem too happy with what's just happened. The U.S. wasn't too happy with 9/11. But there's a range of stuff going on and a range of responses. I mean, Shira, in Washington, you're writing about Congressman Joe Barton saying maybe we need to close down ISIS websites. What about more than that? Is there actually a move on to give Brennan, CIA Director Brennan, what he wants?
I think that we're seeing a lot of senators and congressmen who are going to be proposing legislation in the coming weeks to give Brennan exactly what he wants. But I think, as often happens when a horrific attack takes place, is that there's legislation and then there's sort of a reconsideration of that legislation. Mm-hmm. I think that Joe Barton's suggestion that any site that hosts ISIS content be taken down was answered very, very quickly by the FCC to say that's not our prerogative. We don't monitor the web. We're not here to police free speech. There's very, very clear rules on things like net neutrality, and the FCC does not want to get involved with that. I mean, if you start taking down any site that hosts ISIS, are you taking down Twitter? Are you taking down Facebook? I mean, YouTube? What mm-hmm. are you taking down? I mean, these ISIS doesn't just exist on the dark web. It exists on every platform. They're very adept at that. And if you do take down Telegram, which is one of the encrypted channels on which they're now communicating a lot of their missives, fine, you take down Telegram. There aren't 100 other options out there for them. They'll find a way to disseminate the information, whether it's on the dark web or whether it's on open social media platforms. I think the bigger question is, how do you deal with this physical territory they control in Iraq and Syria, and where is your actual human intelligence coming from?
So there's the Texas congressman's idea. Take all this stuff down. What about the CIA director? What does he want? If he could have – does he want everything?
I mean, I'm not in his head, right? But mm-hmm. I think that he's made it very clear he'd like backdoor access to things, everything from an iPhone iMessage, which is encrypted, to Facebook, which has now started encrypting its messaging, and PGP keys, and all these programs that people use. As one of the callers earlier said, these are programs that are used by political dissidents. These are people who are used by NGO workers. And these are programs that are used by journalists when we're out in the field in a hostile country. We want to tell our editor what time our flight is. Mm-hmm. I think that these are programs that are used by a wide variety of people, and saying they want access to all of it is a very dangerous request.
Here's last year, Apple CEO Tim Cook talked with Charlie Rose about encryption and privacy at Apple.
If the government laid a subpoena on us to get your iMessages, we can't provide it. It's encrypted and we don't have the key. In the Snowden thing, just to go long on that for just a moment, is what we wanted was we wanted instantly to be totally transparent. Because there were rumors and things being written in the press that people had back doors to our servers and all this kind of stuff. Right. None of that is true. We would never allow that to happen. They would have to cart us out in a box.
Silicon Valley, not exactly signing up there. They'd have to cart us out in a box. The Apple CEO, Tim Cook, telling Charlie Rose there. Sure, Frankel, Aaron Brantley, please stand by. Jamil Jaffer joins us now from New York, Deputy Legal Director, Director of the Center for Democracy at the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. Jamil Jaffer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And from Washington, Dakota Wood is here, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Dakota Wood, thanks for being with us today.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
Mr. Wood, what do you think about John Brennan's, in effect, his call for more free rein when it comes to surveillance? Is the Paris cluster of attacks on Friday the signal that the time has come to give more back to the CIA?
No, I think your other commentators have been right on the ball, that there is always this pendulum swing where you have some kind of catastrophic attack. There are immediate demands for more access to more intelligence and information. How could this have happened? You know, where did things slip through the cracks? I mean, those are natural reactions. People then scramble to see how much more. Then you have people that we're in fully in support of civil liberties or privacy, you know, those kinds of things, you know, the intrusiveness of government, et cetera, that you want to stem that a bit. And so that tension that's already been discussed here is the right tension. It has to be this public debate about how much privacy and civil liberty do you want to give up. in the name of security. So if I was in the intelligence community, I'm going to want as much access to as much information as possible to ward against being caught by surprise. I mean, that's just a natural thing. The other elements of government and of the public at large is your balance to that. It's the check. You know, how much do you want to release or to give up? So I think there's a natural tension there that shouldn't catch anybody by surprise.
Jamil Jaffer, do you see right now, beyond the rhetoric of the CIA chief, do you see a real push to give more latitude to American intelligence agencies to spy on Americans and others?
Well, you know, I'm encouraged by what's been said so far this hour, because there doesn't seem to be anyone who agrees with the CIA director that more power is necessary. You know, this is a predictable and it's the same playbook after every attack, right? After every attack, the intelligence community says it needs more surveillance authority. And, you know, I don't think that we should dismiss those kinds of demands out of hand. I think that we should take them seriously. But we also need to recognize that they say the same thing after every single attack. And in many situations, what happens is we learn later that the problem wasn't a lack of information. The problem wasn't that the government didn't have the information it needed, but rather that the government didn't act on or didn't understand the information it already had. And that seems to, I mean, it's still early, but it seems to have been the case here. Three of the attackers were apparently already under surveillance. Four of them had criminal records. Five of them had visited Syria recently. So, you know, the French government already had a lot of information. The same was true with the 9/11 attacks, right? Right after 9/11, the U.S. government demanded more surveillance power. We gave it more surveillance power with the Patriot Act, which was passed in October of 2001. And then the 9/11 report came out, the 9/11 Commission report, and it said, and this was its main message, really, that the problem wasn't that we didn't have the information, but that we didn't understand the information we already had, and we didn't share it with the right people. And so, you know, I think that often the problem isn't that we're not collecting the dots, but that we're not connecting the dots. And so we should be skeptical of claims and demands of the kind that the CIA director is making right now.
Aaron Brantley, at the same time, I mean, we want civil liberties, we want constitutional rights and privacy protected, but Americans and many others also want first-class security, and nobody wants to see what happened in Paris happening there or anywhere else. So if it's not a wider net to be thrown, elaborate further, Aaron, on where you think we can and should do better. How?
Well, I think that it should be noted that the Central Intelligence Agency and the Federal Bureau of Investigation have so far done a very good job of catching a large number of people. If you read through some of the just press releases on the FBI's website, you can see a lot of the people they catch going into the stream. You have organizations like the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point and others that do open source tracking of foreign fighters. And so there's a lot of areas where we can try and inform to try and make better decisions as we gain more intelligence or more information on these individuals. And so this is a process by which we all have to kind of work together, but it shouldn't be a process where we give up our liberty and privacy. You know, as Ben Franklin said, his famous quote on liberty and privacy, those who would forsake a little bit of liberty for privacy for security
deserve neither. We got it, but there's Dianne Feinstein. We just heard it saying she feels like she felt before 9/11, and we didn't catch that. I mean, nobody wants that to happen again.
That's, you know, so I think that, you know, we can live in fear of the unknown, or we can accept that there are certain unknowns that happen in this world, and we can move forward, and we can develop our country on the values that we hold dear. And if we do that, then I think that we will have won the battle against the terrorists far more than if we give in to a security state.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the push post-Paris for more, not less, electronic surveillance. The head of the CIA doesn't want to be constrained, wants more access, calls a lot of the pushback on that hand-wringing. We're looking at the tension, maybe perpetual in this age, over rights and privacy and the way all that has come back after the attacks in Paris. Sheriff Frankel is with us, cybersecurity reporter for BuzzFeed. Aaron Brantley's here. He's a research fellow at the U.S. Army Cyber Institute, professor at West Point. Jamil Jaffer is here from the ACLU, and Dakota Wood from the Heritage Foundation. You can join us. What do you think? Are you looking at your Sony PlayStation in a new light today? Do we have to win this offline, ultimately? How important is the online piece? I mean, you've got law enforcement officials out there talking about this. Bill Bratton, now New York City Police Commissioner, on MSNBC's Morning Joe, just on Monday, talked about the difficulties of not being able to cut through encrypted apps and websites and collect information.
We encounter that frequently where we're monitoring and they go dark because basically they're going on to an encrypted app. They're going on to sites that we cannot access. Director Comey, the FBI, has been talking about this with increasing frequency. We've been supporting that conversation with major city chiefs because we're seeing it every day where we are losing the ability to gather intelligence. And we are losing a lot of that intelligence momentum because of this issue.
Bert in Austin, Texas. Bert, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that I'm happy to hear that Anonymous is getting involved since they are not restricted by the same legal restrictions that our government agencies are. And so they're able to do, they're more familiar with the dark web, and so they're able to traverse it and shut down that activity probably potentially more effectively than our government officials can.
Our auxiliary unit here in Anonymous, you never know which way they're going to go. I don't know if that's a lynch mob or a super tech posse. Let me test that thesis. Aaron Brantley, how about it? Unconstrained by law, Anonymous. Can it do something that the NSA and CIA and everybody else cannot?
No, I think that, you know, opening up to non-state actors engaging in offensive cyber actions in cyberspace opens up a bad Pandora's box. We need to be cautious and cognizant of this type of behavior. First of all, they are breaking a lot of laws when they engage in this type of behavior. It's not that I don't respect their sentiments and efforts. I just think that we have to be cognizant of the fact that these are issues that are best reserved for states and law enforcement agencies.
Jamil, how do you look at that? At the ACLU, here's a non-state actor saying, we're going to go after them. Are you as vigorous in your watchdog role when it comes to non-state actors as you are with authorities, Jamil?
You know, I guess I'm skeptical that Anonymous is going to have any abilities here that the NSA doesn't. You know, the NSA hires more mathematicians than anyone else in the world. It's a very, very powerful agency, which is part of the reason why we think that there ought to be, you know, real safeguards against against abuse. But if I could just respond to the earlier caller who's mm-hmm. talking about the going dark concern. You know, I think that that concern is way, way overstated. The government
has never
had... Oh,
that was Bill Bratton, the New York police chief there, you're referring to.
I think you're right. Yeah. But I think that concern is way overstated. The government has never had access to every communication. You know, when we have a conversation in our living rooms or we have a conversation on the subway, you know, nobody's writing that down. And they've never had access to those kinds of conversations. So it's not as if the fact that the government lacks access to a certain class of communications is a new thing. It's always been there. And we live now in kind of a golden age of surveillance. You know, everything we do online leaves a digital trail. And that opens up all sorts of surveillance possibilities that weren't there 10 or 20 years ago. So your location can be tracked. Everything you buy can be tracked. Every one of your communications can be tracked. Even if the government doesn't have access to content, it can track all of those things. And so, you know, there are two sides of the ledger here. Even if it is true to some extent that the technology is making it difficult for the government to access some communications, technology is also giving the government a lot more power than it ever had before. And overall, I think it's that trend that is much more important and much stronger. The government has more surveillance authority now than it has ever enjoyed before. And again, I don't mean to say that we shouldn't take seriously, you know, claims or demands from the government for more power. If there really are gaps and that prevent the government from accessing communications that we think it should have access to, then we should talk about that. But the government hasn't been able to point to that so far, and it's doubtful that they'll be able to point to it given how much surveillance power they have right now.
I mean, Dakota Wood, we don't want to be blasé about the threat. It was guns and suicide vests in Paris. Could be worse somewhere else. Do you see legitimate gaps in American coverage right now? I mean, Jamil says, look, they have more power than ever. Are there inappropriate gaps by your lights, Dakota, in our tech capacity, surveillance capacity now?
Well, I think what hasn't been addressed, but what's been implied, especially by Jamil and getting into it by Aaron as well, is that we've become over-reliant on cyber and electronic surveillance measures, right? So as Jamil has already pointed out, we're awash in data, right, that overwhelms the system to analyze anyway. You're never going to have, you know, perfect insight via electronic means alone. So the real gap becomes in human intelligence and developing agents and gaining access into very closed groups, whether it's a criminal cartel or a terrorist cell. It's built on relationships and personal knowledge. How do you get into the closed-door meetings to even put in a listening advice or to turn somebody in there that can talk to you about a handwritten transmission or a courier on a motorbike? You know, that's where the gap has occurred that's generated over decades. And so we've become overly dependent on electronic means, which generates the kind of conversations that we're going with. And just one other quick point, there is a difference between law enforcement actions bounded by legal code to build a legal case to prosecute, and warfighting or security actions which prevent attacks or to defeat an enemy. And so to presume that the U.S. government has some say-so over what Anonymous does, if they're an independent entity and they're going to do what they're going to do, then that's what they're going to do, whether they're successful or not remains to be seen. But there are these differences between building legal cases for prosecution and defeating an enemy force. There is a difference between human intelligence and working sources and being overly dependent on electronic means.
A couple of big issues raised there. I mean, human intelligence first. Sheriff Frankel, you've been thinking about this, reporting on this. I mean, maybe the reason that we embrace the tech side so firmly is it's not easy to get into the Central Council chambers in Raqqa and sit around and hear what ISIS has in mind. This is pretty tough nut to crack on the human intelligence side.
Exactly. And when you talk to an actual intelligence operative, an American who is working in these countries, who's working in Jordan and working in Turkey, the number one complaint they have is not that they're lacking signals intelligence or, you know, intelligence they get from online.
Digital stuff and radio and all those.
That's not what they're worried about. They're worried about human intelligence. What they're saying is long gone are the days where the U.S. is pouring resources into developing assets abroad, into developing informants. There's been a huge push away from that since 9/11, despite the fact that following 9/11, there was time and time again people coming forward and saying what we need are human assets, what we need is human intelligence. You've got groups like Al-Qaeda using carrier pigeons. You've got Hamas in the Gaza Strip. I saw once writing a letter on a piece of toilet paper that got flushed down the toilet afterwards. You have them using very, very low-tech means to communicate with one another. And when you have a vacuum of information in a place as large as what ISIS is able to do in Iraq and Syria to create that caliphate, when you have a vacuum of real sort of human intelligence coming out of there, that's what keeps them up awake at night. That's what keeps the CIA really awake at night is saying, wow, look, there's this entire territory where we've physically gone dark.
Aaron Brantley, that sounds like a tough nut to crack. But my question here is this. We have presumed now for years that the high-tech advantage would be ours. But I wonder if the technology there has evolved in such a way that the digital realm actually now gives an advantage to ISIS. With all this encryption, it is hard to hack and track. For all of our supercapacity, as Dakota says, you can have so much capacity, you're just awash in stuff. Is the digital realm actually a realm of advantage ISIS today, Aaron?
So I would say no, it's not to their advantage. I'd say that it kind of puts them more in line with being able to plan faster, more efficiently, be able to communicate in some new ways. But the fundamental resource constraints of transnational terrorists still quite significantly apply. How they pre-position assets, how they get those assets into locations, how they do operational planning, how they build their familial and home networks. And I think Shira brought up the fundamental point, is that a lot of this requires building relationships into communities, developing human assets, and then using that in combination with digital and signal means to try and triangulate who's going to do what when.
Cedric in Nashville, Tennessee. Cedric, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that, first of all, the words of Anonymous, the hacktivist group, actually encourages me, not because I actually think that they would be any kind of savior to us, but that it at least gives us the idea. I'm wanting to at least assume that the CIA and the NSA, our protective forces, can actually do at least as much, can be as effectual as they can. And if they are as bold as to say that we are tracking ISIS, then we should be able to have faith that the CIA does not need a larger hole, a larger risk broadened and made in, you know, the national security, the security of commerce. And
yeah,
we're talking about unconventional means of communication among ISIS in the first place, which is the reason we're having this conversation. So I don't see how that would help anyway. Signals intercepting, signals intelligence and encryption, I don't know how those things would. And Americans, of course, really enjoy their privacy. As an African American, I'm constantly cognizant of the fact that police officers around the country are currently cringing under civilian surveillance. I mean, we are very much about privacy, and so I don't see how the risk is merited by such an invasion.
Cedric, I think we got the heart of it right there, and I understand emotionally, hey, if Anonymous can do this, surely the CIA can do it. Of course, everyone is also playing a PR game here as well. Anonymous wants to be seen as all-powerful, and so does the CIA, so does ISIS, for that matter. I mean, the PR part of the digital realm is no small thing either. One more right here. Chris in Boston. Chris, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I'm a computer scientist by profession, and my point is, aside from any of the policy issues, the technical challenge that the security agencies have asked for is pretty much technically impossible. All the encryption is based
on... You mean the back door that they appear to want?
Right. Most of the encryption is based on mathematics that's extremely well studied, that's been extensively published in the open literature. Anybody who's an upper-level undergraduate CS major or a first-year graduate student could, over the course of a weekend, write a pretty decent encryption piece of software. If you manage to compel Apple or Facebook or Verizon to put in a backdoor, there's really nothing stopping the bad guys from writing their own and distributing it or using something they've downloaded off the Internet.
And suddenly they're in through the back door and spying on us.
Not necessarily.
Oh, you mean their own encryption if we take away the package products.
Right.
Okay, I got it.
They could write and distribute their own encryption software. You could, of course, make it illegal to do that, but that's not going to stop the bad guys. So the notion of compelling the major commercial providers, a previous caller alluded to this, the notion of compelling the major commercial providers to put in a backdoor inconveniences the vast number of legitimate users with a fairly small gain in control over the bad guys.
Because they could make their own encryption. Chris, I appreciate your call. I mean, Jamil Jaffer at the ACLU, Silicon Valley has pushed back very hard on the backdoor idea. They want to be seen as creating reliable products globally, and they've reported it's hurt them in their sales sometimes. There's certainly their reputation if they appear to be playing so much footsie with American surveillance. Do you see, there's been a hard fight to push back on some of the Patriot Act stuff here over the last years. Do you see a real push on now to increase American intelligence authorities' writ for surveillance, or is this just chatter in the week after a terrible, terrible weekend?
I hope it's the latter. You know, part of the reason the tech companies have been so resistant is that they realize that the solution, or so-called solution, that the government is proposing is not a solution at all. That if the government, as one of your callers said, you know, if the government has access through the back door to these kinds of communications, then everybody else is going to have access too. You can't control who goes through that back door. It could be the Russian government tomorrow, the Chinese government, or it could be non-state actors. It could be Russian criminals. You know, once you have introduced that kind of vulnerability, you can't limit it to the kinds of circumstances that John Brennan presumably has in mind. And then on top of that, you know, as another caller said, you know, this kind of backdoor solution affects only people who use centralized technology. So it's only if, you know, with Apple controls the device in your hand, right, or controls the software that runs on the device in your hand. But if you have peer-to-peer encryption technology, as many of these terrorist groups undoubtedly would have if we imposed a backdoor requirement on Apple and similar companies, then the backdoor requirement's not going to help. It's not going to give the government access to those communications. So all you're going to do is you're going to prevent the rest of us from using encryption. And we rely on encryption every day. We rely on encryption to buy things online, to do our banking, to visit our doctor's offices online, you know, to get our medical records. All of that is made possible through encryption. And it's you know, reckless to endanger all of that with the kinds of proposals that the CIA director seems to be favoring.
Sure, Frankel, last word's going to go to you here today. People, on the other hand, do not want to see a Paris-style attack or anything like it, or worse, in the U.S. or anywhere else. Do you see the pendulum swinging again here, or have we reached a kind of a workable place despite what CIA Director Brennan says?
I think it's very hard to tell in the days, the hours following an attack like what we saw in Paris, where emotions are going to be in a week or two. While I'm sure that there are people in the CIA and in the government who want to open every single door and have, you know, backdoor access to everything, get rid of encryption, I'm sure that would be great for them. I think that we're going to see a lot of sort of calmer heads prevail in the coming weeks, and I don't think there'll be that kind of massive push towards access.
We are, for better or worse, gaining experience of living in this age of terror, and maybe with that a little more calm maturity about it. Security, privacy, it's all important. Shira Frankel with BuzzFeed. It's so great to see you. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Dakota Wood at the Heritage Foundation in Washington. Thank you for joining us, Dakota.
Enjoyed it.
Jamil Jaffer at the ACLU in New York. Thanks, Jamil.
Thank you.
And Aaron Brantley, author of the forthcoming The Decision to Attack, Military and Intelligence Cyber Decision-Making at West Point. Professor Brantley, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you as well.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.